All right, we're going to begin the meeting for tonight. So, hope everyone's ready. Welcome the guests. This is the LaRouche Youth Movement here in Montreal. A weekly meeting. We have a youth movement organizing here in Montreal that is part of an international youth movement associated with the American statesman and political economist Lyndon LaRouche, who is right now at the center of an international political fight to reorganize and restructure the world economic system. That's going to be the basic concept that we're going to discuss tonight, is where we're currently located historically, what we're doing as a political movement, and the policy orientation that we personally are leading through our organizing internationally in government institutions, all layers of the population, all layers of university and intellectual life. We're shaping politics through the initiatives that we're taking up, which we'll discuss tonight, and we'll give you guys some familiarity with what we're up to. So I'm just going to go briefly through some of the recent political developments, just to kind of situate where we are and where we stand and what we're involved in. I imagine everyone here has read or at least got a chance to receive this pamphlet. You guys have it? No? Okay. Well, you can take it with you. This is a recent webcast that Lyndon LaRouche gave March 7th in Washington, D.C., which was an international policy dialogue drawing out the implications of the U.S. Congress continuing to tolerate Al Gore and the hoax he's pushing in global warming. We're going to get into how that's being organized today. But first, I wanted to just give you guys a brief sense of our latest strategic initiative here, which has to deal with our website. It's the LaRouche Political Action Committee website. This is a key focus to what our organization is doing right now. We have, as part of our youth movement operations, a war room function, which has to deal with structured around five or six man staff composed of youth representing different regions of the United States who have volunteered or been selected from our youth movement to come out to our national center in Leesburg, Virginia, to be part of an intelligence staff working very close with the staff that is actively working on putting together our weekly intelligence magazine, EIR, the Executive Intelligence Review, which there's copies floating around. There's this week's copy that we have here in case anyone is interested in taking one. But we have an intelligence staff full-time in the United States and in Europe. And the idea with EIR magazine is to produce an updated weekly intelligence journal for policymakers around the world. We've been doing this for about 30-plus years, which EIR has been in print. Recently, as of last year, due to the continuing influence of our youth movement, we set up a war room operation to bring the youth into the intelligence process, collecting reports from the field, different interventions that we're making different interventions we're making and our political organizing, responses we're getting, keeping track of our work in the U.S. Congress, etc., but also initiating strategic studies based on the responses and what we're collecting from the political work that we're doing. So the War Room has been involved in doing that and also kind of leading and coordinating the deployments of our youth movement. And what we've recently done is we've added another layer on to this intelligence function, which is another group of youth who have been, as of this week, deployed also into our national center where all of our operations are located in the United States, to particularly manage the website, which Lyndon LaRouche's outlook on this thing, which he's been trying to initiate for a very long time, to bring the actual website and the intelligence picture to life a little bit, so we're able to project a real-time sense of political developments around the world as they happen, which can be constantly updated. So we gave the task to the youth, who are more than willing and energetic and creatively capable of handling the work. And what the intention is to shape the politics of the political discussion around the world, and particularly, how you doing? Good to see you again. Particularly shape the political and intellectual culture of the 18 to 35 young adult generation, which is critical right now, because I don't want to get off the subject, but just to get to what we're doing with the website, our main political audience right now strategically is the 18 to 35 generation, specifically because we have about not even a decade or so until the current generation in power, the baby boomer generation, is going to be, for various different reasons, becoming the outgoing generation politically, and more increasingly over the next 8 to 10 years, say, for example, given a significant change in the United States where we elect a president who's capable of managing and bringing under control the world economic and political situation. Say that president is able to serve 2 terms, 8 years, we managed to change the country significantly, change the world. By the time that president is outgoing, the political life of the world is going to be dominated by the youth generation. That's something to look forward to. So, what we intend to do is use our webpage as a political news source for this young adult generation, so that when people wake up in the morning, they get their breakfast, they check their email, they can go directly to our site and get an overnight picture of what's developed. And we're keeping it updated constantly 3 or 4 times a day, following up on some of the strategic leads that we're putting out in the morning. And you can get a sense how it operates just by going through it. So I'll just put that out there just to make sure that people are aware of that and are keeping up with what we're doing, because Lyndon LaRouche's outlook right now is that this generation, 18 to 35, is going to shape presidential politics in the United States. And he recently addressed a town hall meeting of our youth movement in Los Angeles, where we have a Democratic club inside the LA County Democratic Central Committee. It's called the Franklin Roosevelt Legacy Club. Lyndon LaRouche addressed this town hall meeting, which there were about 120, 140 people in attendance, outlining some of the strategic parameters of where we are and where we're headed. So the main focus really was the role primarily in the focus of the youth generation politically and their orientation intellectually, and also what we will have a class on tonight, a policy to create a new international economic system, political economic system, involving a return back to the legacy and policy orientation that Franklin Roosevelt had for a post-war war world after 1945 through his own initiative in setting up the Bretton Woods system and intending to have a the United Nations as the international diplomatic corps to manage and shape the post-war world recovery. And I mentioned this last week, but I'll also reemphasize it again because it's important to keep in mind what Franklin Roosevelt's intention was after the war by setting up the Bretton Woods and the UN was to dissolve the British Empire, to dissolve a colonial system of government, and use American methods, use the political economic machine that was driven into motion in the United States before and throughout the war to develop the backwards countries of the British colonies. And there was a direct confrontation between Churchill and Roosevelt on this question, and it's documented by FDR's son, Elliot Roosevelt, who was a political advisor to the president. I kind of admire the relationship, actually. But it's very good that Elliot Roosevelt was able to capture this because it gives us an understanding of what the fight has been since the death of President Roosevelt. So what Lyndon LaRouche is saying in the name of FDR and in his name as an American political figure, in order to get agreements going among nation states, first of all, you need cooperation of the four major superpowers of the world. And he has various specific reasons why he's naming these four nations. He's saying, first of all, the United States because of our political system. Russia, India, China. He laid that out at this conference to our town hall meeting in Los Angeles. And he's saying specifically these nations need to be the core and leadership for other nations to be rallied and recruited around to make this reorganization possible, because the world is bankrupt today. Monetarily, there's a hands-down argument proving that. And physically also, nobody in their right mind can confront the condition of most human beings on the planet and be honestly say to themselves or any other person that the economy is doing fine. So these nations in particular, Lyndon LaRouche is saying, one, you want to have an alliance between these nations because they are the four superpowers of the world. Secondly, is these are the leaders of these nations, upon being organized, will act and cooperate with each other to defend the sovereignty of their own nations against globalization. They'll do that. They're willing to do that, and we see this more explicitly coming out of Russia, where they've personally evoked the name and legacy of FDR within their government. Even President Putin has been using quotes by Franklin Roosevelt in his speeches on defense, and in fact, in February. There was a 120th birthday that passed of FDR, and the government of Russia sponsored a conference where many of the ministers of the Russian government prepared presentations and speeches on specifically Roosevelt, and they're saying that FDR is a real American president that we that we want to associate with. So that was, and we're organizing around this internationally. We're working in the U.S. Congress. We've got a youth movement in Washington D.C. Youth movement in Berlin, Germany, which is kind of the American and European front of our political operations, which are, we also have offices in different countries also, where we do have youth deployed in Mexico, Argentina, Philippines, across Europe. So this is an international effort, and once again, I'll just reemphasize that it's being driven by the leading representatives of the youth generation who are working with Lyndon LaRouche, and actively creating a political environment where this process can be moved forward, can be discussed beyond what's currently accepted. And I want to get into that because there, as you all know, we've taken up a pretty serious fight politically on the global warming hoax that Al Gore is pushing. And the reason why is because of what I just stated. Our intention is to have a reorganization of the world economic system and develop a future orientation for the planet and civilization as a whole through means of economic and scientific development and cultural development through policies and agreements among sovereign nation states. We want to have an economic system that's based on that type of model. Treaty agreements for 25, 30-year development perspectives based on a general welfare policy, a policy of the common good. So that's kind of what we're doing. We can have more discussion a little bit later, and we have a lot of literature you all can take a look at to find out more of the specific details what we're involved in. But we've taken up a fight against this global warming hoax because it is a threat to international policy right now. And Al Gore knows exactly what he's doing. Don't get it mixed up. He's been hired by the British government as an advisor, brought in, and he also runs a hedge fund out of London, which specializes in carbon trade. So that's one aspect of material that we put out. The other thing is that Al Gore is just a fat Southern racist. He's specifically, his history has been tied up before he went to Congress. He was picked up and used as a lackey to FBI officers in Tennessee to run stings against black elected officials, try to run them out of politics. And he probably gets it from his father, who turned his back on the U.S. Congress and voted against the Civil Rights Bill when it was being discussed and debated in 1963, 1964. Not to mention, just to pile it on a little bit, Gore's attacks on Africa as Vice President of the United States, when he personally confronted the President of South Africa and forced him to back down on programs that were already moving forward in South Africa to develop generic prescription drugs to try to regulate and deal with the spread of HIV and AIDS. Al Gore told the president of South Africa that either he cooperate with the pharmaceutical companies or there'll be an embargo, an economic embargo on South Africa from the United States. So he is a racist, and his environmental policies reflect that right now, currently, toward the developing sector, toward India, toward Africa, toward South America. Because he's a British operative, his idol and his environmental big brother is Prince Philip, who made a statement that he, in the event of his demise, if he had one wish, he would wish to return, he'd wish to be reincarnated and come back to planet Earth as a deadly virus so that he can contribute something good to overpopulation. And this is the guy who is the role model of Al Gore. And we recently published a lot more background on where this old British outlook of environmentalism and conservation and population control comes from, which is documented in an article by Rob Ainsworth on environmental eugenics. Al Gore is a green genocide. It's in last week's EIR. But this racism comes from race science, which was organized to attempt to establish a superior image of the Anglo-Saxon race in the world. They're trying to scientifically prove that the Anglo species is more physiologically, intellectually capable of dominating the planet. So that's just generally where Al Gore comes from. Like I said, we've got volumes of studies and reports that we've done in EIR that you can read and we can talk about and fight over. But that's what we're dealing with. And this is what our youth movement is organizing against. And the reason it's so critical to go after Gore right now and break down this environmental insanity is because it's being pushed right now on the youth generation, but also the baby boomers, because they're a little bit, they're not willing to actually go all the way and do certain things politically. Like, for example, Lyndon LaRouche has been giving a series of webcasts over the past 3 years where he's been basically advising the Democratic Party on political strategy. And, you know, what they're saying is, you know, we do agree with you that the we are in a collapse phase of the world economic system. But the situation here in Washington, D.C., in the United States, is not politically ripe to initiate the type of reforms that you're talking about. So can you outline an alternative strategy which is a little bit more reserved and less radical towards challenging the financiers? And this is where the Democrats have gotten themselves into a lot of serious trouble, because LaRouche initiated the fight in 2005 to save the automotive industry from being dismantled. We organized a whole delegation of elected officials and labor leaders to pass resolutions in state legislatures, Democratic clubs and committees nationwide. Leaders from the automotive industry came out, union presidents, scientists, engineers. There was over 200 resolutions passed by different political layers in the United States urging the U.S. Congress to adopt the emergency legislation that Lyndon LaRouche was talking about to retool and save the auto industry. The Democratic Party backed down on that fight under pressure of fear that they wouldn't be funded in their 2006 re-election campaigns. And in a very specific case, the case of Felix Rowatin personally came in and advised the Democratic Party not to listen to LaRouche. Felix Rowatin, we'll get into who he is. But he's also part of this hedge fund business, along with Gore. He's a close collaborator and confidant and colleague of George Shultz. And he's a really nasty guy. Actually, I said this once, many times before, and I'll say it again, he's a Nazi, he's a fascist. Through his own roots, through his own history, where he comes from, who created him. Felix Rowatin is a Nazi. And the Democratic Party has become vulnerable to this guy as a kingpin on the Democratic Leadership Council. So that's one case. The other thing is this Gore stuff. Because the Democratic Party came in very strong after November 6th. After the elections, when they won the Congress, they won the House and the Senate, they came back very strong on the question of the war and the question of the economy. But then again, their unwillingness to go forward and impeach Cheney caused them to become vulnerable to Al Gore and this environmental insanity. So we're addressing this, we're taking it up, fighting it out in the U.S. Congress, fighting it out in the population of the United States, Canada, Mexico, trying to recruit the population to a real solution to this financial collapse. So I want to give a sense of the counter-operations that are being run around this environmentalism, because there's a big counter-operation. And Gore and Felix Rowatin are right at the center of this thing. And the target once again, is the U.S. Congress. The opposition to them, once again, is Lyndon LaRouche. So I'll just get into that. I just have to get something real quick. Can you pass me an EIR?
You want?
Yeah, please. This is the magazine I was talking about. You already know about it. You could probably read it. So there's a study that was produced by one of the youth members who's in the war room right now, Dave Dixon, exposing some of the nest of this environment of the way that the environmental. The financiers who are running the environmental operation are centered, which is Middlebury College in Vermont. And you know where that is? Huh?
Well, I never went there, but
okay.
I know more or less where it is.
Okay, I thought you had a little bit of a
No, I couldn't
reaction.
Imagine the World Central being somewhere in Vermont.
Oh yeah, it's kind of. I mean, that's the route that we go through from Boston to Montreal, and there's not really, it's kind of interesting. Well, actually, if you wanna stretch your imagination a little bit, you probably didn't know either that the hedge fund center of the world is the Cayman Islands.
Wow, that's British more Cayman Islands.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, well, it actually is. The British Cayman Islands. There's about 80% of the world's hedge funds that are spread across these small islands. Yeah, but what we found is through a couple of personalities, and it's a guy named Bill McKibben and Jonathan Isham, who are resident scholars at Middlebury. What they've done is they've taken up a national campaign centered around creating a youth movement, which they're saying, there was an article in Business Week earlier this week that's saying the youth now are concerned about the environment, and this is going to be the biggest youth movement since the Vietnam War. This is going to be nationwide. We're going to take this thing international. The environmental movement is going to take off, and we're going to save the environment. So what they've done initially, it began as just a student coalition, some students who came together, who were concerned about specific environmental issues, and they came to this guy McKibben, who began to advise this student group. And what he has done is he's teamed up with Felix Roatan, because what Roatan has done is he's put about I can't remember the amount of money, somewhere around $11 million into Middlebury College. He's essentially bought himself a seat on the executive board of the university, because this is where he graduated from. And he set up something called the Roatan Institute for International Studies. So what they've done is they've taken this student organization with the environmental outlook, they've teamed it up with the Roatan Institute, and they've collaborated with a very large financial mechanism coming from the Mellon Foundation, the Bechtel Foundation. And what they're doing right now is they're funding a worldwide coalition, but highly concentrated in the United States, to green the campuses in the United States. They're planning on greening America's campuses. And through two front groups, which are heavily funded, one's called Step It Up, and the other is called Focus the Nation. And one of them, Focus the Nation, is being organized by McKibben. The other guy, David Isham, is heading up the Step It Up program. But Isham, he's a person who was directly trained by Gore. I forget what year. I think, actually, sometime this year, apparently, he had a meeting with Al Gore in Tennessee. And the initiative was set forth that the focus of these two groups are going to push the environmental agenda, which right now focus around two things. One, they want to make the presidential election platform in 2008 the environment, specifically global warming. But also, what they want the Congress to do in the meantime is pass laws putting a cap on carbon emissions. And they hope to reduce the amount of CO2 being produced in the atmosphere by 80% by, I think, about 2025 or so. Which, you know, is a pretty modest goal, but thinking about what has to be done to actually do that, how much industry are you going to have to reduce? how much power to the economy just in simple kilowatt measures are going to have to be reduced for production, for water management, for power systems, etc. In order to do that, see, because the whole outlook is, well, we're going to go to more environmentally friendly forms of energy, wind turbines, biodiesel fuels, and solar panels. We're going to have a solar panel on everyone's roof in their home, which is good in some cases, but when you're looking at what actually really needs to be done, just physically to increase the quality of life on the planet, human beings, but also the physical composition of the biosphere, you're never going to solve the problem of having a bad climate if you go to these forms of fuel. Because what you need is you need a high technological and high industrial capacity in order to do the type of things that need to be done to change the conditions on the planet. Like, for one example is the issue of water right now, which is a desperately needed resource. We don't have enough of it. In India, it's a very serious problem. In the southwest of the United States, northern Mexico, the Great American Desert is where I grew up. Really bad out there. The desert is actually expanding. I've been in Boston for about 3 years, and I go back to Los Angeles from time to time, and it's really in the middle of summer and autumn, the hillsides are completely dried out. And the same thing, flying over the desert, there's nothing there. So this is a big problem. It's a big problem because this is a harvest in a breadbasket, as they call it, for potential agricultural production. All you need is water. You can begin to develop new cities and things of that sort. All you need is to have the capability of bringing fresh water into these deserts and begin to make the land habitable. I'm talking about peace in Southwest Asia, sustainable peace, you need water. You don't need democracy at least in the way that George Bush thinks about it. Or some of these lunatics like George Shultz and Henry Kissinger. No, you need water. You want peace, you want sustainable peace. In the Middle East, you want development of Africa, you need water. Today, the only way we can generate the amount of fresh water necessary to begin to change the quality of life on the planet is through nuclear power, nuclear desalination, which is the best way to do it as it stands now, to filter water through a nuclear process, which takes the salt out of the waters of the ocean. And we can do this. We can actually use technology to produce raw materials. This is what human beings are capable of doing. We don't have to adopt these silly energy sources. And actually, nuclear power doesn't emit any CO2. But we don't have to go back to the Stone Age technologically. And if we did, well then, I guess the eugenicists would get their way. We wouldn't be able to do anything about Africa. And out of the billion people in India, in a generation or two, there won't be the second most population dense nation of the world, neither China. So that's what we're talking about. And the people have good intentions who try to get involved in this. But the problem is the bigger picture is evil. And I'll show you an example of that. This is I'm not sure if you heard, but yeah, it's okay. I'm just gonna go back to the previous page. I'm not sure if you heard, but this is pretty bad. There was recently an attempted assassination of the ambassador of Berlin to the international climate change debate a few weeks ago. And just to show you guys how serious the situation has gotten, I'm going to show a little bit of a report on what that is. Did anybody hear about that? The ambassador to the climate change debate from Berlin was an attempted assassination. Yeah. So
ambassador to the climate change debate. Someone from Berlin going to the climate change debate.
Yeah, the official ambassador of Berlin. Yeah, Germany. Yeah, to the international debate on climate change. There was an attempted coup run against. Targeted for assassination. So here's the story. This is a report that we got from our youth movement in Berlin, in Germany. Okay, here's a report. For the first time in 30 years, a female polar bear recently had two babies. One baby died, and the surviving cub, which would have died also. However, a group of people wanted to save the bear and have cared. Actually, can you pause it? Okay, so here's a report. For the first time, which is not, doesn't occur too often, for the first time in 30 years, a female polar bear recently had two babies. One baby died, and apparently the mother was so sad she turned her back on the surviving cub, which would have also died. However, a group of people wanted to save the bear and have it cared for by the zoo. This enraged the greenies, who said this was interfering with the natural order of things. Thereupon, the greenies formed a plot to liquidate the cub by lethal injection. A campaign was launched to rescue the cub from the lunatic greens, and the bear was eventually saved. Now, the baby polar bear, named Knut, is, according to zoo director Bernard Blazkiewicz, Berlin's ambassador to the international climate change debate, and has a bodyguard keeper to raise him, and is well protected from future assassination plots. Why would somebody want to kill that little polar bear? Throwing off the natural order of things to save his life. He's supposed to die as a beast. And human beings want to do good things and save these cubs. Sheesh. So, I mean, it's funny, but it's true. But their outlook towards human beings is the same thing on the higher levels, because these what's being run out of Middlebury and what's being spread in campuses all across the United States, especially university campuses, with this whole green agenda, this is heavily funded. Heavily funded. Like I said, the idea is to make the presidential election campaign focused on the environment. So that's kind of where we are a little bit in terms of the two leading fronts of political life of young people today at large is really a division between what we're doing and what the environmental movement has on their agenda, which really isn't the environmental movement's agenda at all. Because the agenda is not the environment. The agenda is actually to stop what LaRouche is doing. Stop a reorganization of the world economic system. To have globalization. To not have any sovereign nation states with the authority to intervene in a time of global crisis. But to have a well-managed international financial system dictated by private finance and independent and private banks. And that's what Gore represents. That's who he is. It's this. He's not a good spokesman. I mean, they chose the wrong guy to put on the front lines because he's a coward and he's not intellectual at all. Like, for example, this week there was three separate calls. Well, there was one call for a debate against Gore. It came out of the British House of Lords. A guy named Lord Monckton of Brenchley, part of the British House of Lords, and he put out a small article in the Washington Post early this week calling out Al Gore for a debate on global warming. Al Gore refused to respond. And since, I think, Monday or Tuesday, the article has been rerun in the Wall Street Journal and also in the New York Times. So this guy, Lord Monckton, is pushing a debate at Gore on global warming publicly. And he's got a little bit of background on this global warming issue. He put out a 40-page report arguing against climate change, arguing against CO2 emissions. I think the title was Armageddon Canceled. And it was a 40-page refutation of global warming. And also in 2005, the British House of Lords also they put out a statement calling for an inquiry into the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Control or Climate Change, the IPCC. Basically to act as an advisory board which would verify the materials that were being run through the IPCC on this climate change. And another thing that he called for, we contacted his office, Lord Monckton, and we talked to him personally through EIR. And what he's saying is, he told us that he thinks that the environmentalists right now who are hysterical about global warming remind him of the National Socialists of pre-Hitler Germany, and he also said in response to our policies for development, he's saying that he recently put out a call for the United Kingdom to start building 12 nuclear power plants. And this is significant because it indicates that there's a move also from London, from Britain, for an opposition to what Gore and Prince Philip and Prince Charles are pushing on this climate change. And there was also a documentary aired in the beginning of March by a Channel 4 media station in Britain called The Great Global Warming Swindle. This was put together by a delegation of scientists from around the world who put out a refutation of Al Gore's movie, and also through them came forth some pretty interesting hypotheses about what causes climate change and how weather patterns are bound within a larger astronomical phenomenon taking place in the solar system. And also recently there was a news report that was put out in the newspaper called Bild Zeitung in Germany, which is one of the leading tabloids in Germany, that had a front page article or a front page or page two article attacking Al Gore. So what Linda LaRouche is saying is that this is significant because there's a faction in Europe who is deciding to go against this. Somebody in Europe is deciding to take this up and push against these policies, which is good. But that's the fight on that, just to kind of put it in perspective, why we're going after Gore, why it's absolutely important to have a certain scientific certainty under our belts as young people to be able to go out and fight out and debate and discuss the real scientific principles involved in what determines climate change. And this is what we're doing with our work on Kepler. Our approach is, well, you want to know something about the sun, you want to know something about the Earth and that relationship and how climate changes, you have to know something about gravitation. You have to know something about how this relationship changes as a phenomenon that is being expressed by a universal characteristic of gravity. That's where you begin. You don't begin with CO2. You don't begin with greenhouse gases. You don't begin with mankind being the cause for climate change. You start with the solar system, and you take it from there. You find out what is the characteristic nature of the way the solar system operates and how it changes. And you begin to make your assessment and hypothesis based on that. Otherwise, there's no science involved. You want to see if something's valid universally. If you experience a phenomenon that you were able to measure or identify in the small, measure it against the larger nature of what is knowable about the universe, and see if it holds out. If it doesn't, you may have to change your mind, which isn't a bad thing. Kepler actually enjoys it the most when he's challenged to completely reorganize the way he's thinking, because he's been going down the path of a wrong and a bunk hypothesis and a bunk system for 5 or so years. And that's communicated through his work. He's completely joyful and empowered by the fact that he was wrong. And that now he has the capability of reformulating his whole hypothesis about the nature of the solar system. So that's what we're doing. We're taking it up from Kepler's standpoint. We're defending Kepler on this issue. We're bringing back real science. We also have an orientation toward art that's involved in that, which isn't separate from the work we're doing on science. And I wouldn't be able to get into that right now because it probably requires a presentation in and of itself. But those are available on our website. Our youth movement has just been involved in two serious projects, taking up Kepler's work on the new astronomy and also the harmonies of the world. And we have a very intense music program in the work of Johann Sebastian Bach in conjunction with the work on Kepler to get at what real science is, what real idea is, what real physics are, and what passion is. And that's the orientation. I just want to get back, go over a few strategic developments that put us right in the middle of our situation today, politically and strategically in the world, before we get into the class, because what is going to be taken up tonight in a more in-depth approach, in a more scientific and artistic and philosophical presentation, would be the four nation strategy that Lyndon LaRouche is talking about, and specifically our outlook and orientation toward the next 50 years. So a couple of things, because in addition to this fight going on inside the Democratic Party to save their soul and bring back Franklin Roosevelt, there's still a problem in the executive branch. And we're receiving constant reports coming in from people that we're working with in the Senate, people that we're working with in and around Washington, D.C., who are saying that, you know, more than ever before, the president's psychological condition is rapidly deteriorating, where he's becoming enraged and very angry. He feels very isolated because his core group of fellows are now being taken down politically, such as the case of Alberto Gonzalez right now, more specifically. He feels as if his comrades are being attacked. They're being taken away from his inner circle, which has been his defense mechanism against reality ever since he's become president. It's a very tight group of advisors. And now that reality is penetrating that politically and legally, Bush is showing himself to be very strained and very weak mentally. So there's constant outlashes when certain things don't go the right way in the White House. And it's a dangerous situation because, as we know from Dr. Justin Frank, Bush is clinically insane. And that's a real fact of life for the world today, that the President of the United States does suffer psychologically from a whole list of symptoms in various different degrees. To factor in international politics, I would think. But it's dangerous because you can have a psychological collapse if things become too difficult for him to manage. A lot of people like to crack jokes about Bush, but this is not the time to joke about this because Cheney's still around. And if Bush goes down, LaRouche is saying he's like Julius Caesar right now, where the Republican Party is, I mean, right now, politically prepared to stab him to death because he's so incompetent, because the White House just doesn't function in conjunction with the agenda of the Congress, especially on the Iraq question. He's talking about vetoing again the appropriations bill, which would effectively cut off the funding for the American troops in Iraq. It wouldn't be the Congress, although the Congress did insert that if the president vetoed the appropriation, the military appropriations bill, they would cut the funds. They would vote to stop funding the war and put together a withdrawal policy to bring U.S. troops back. Now Bush is talking about, well, look, you're trying to get me in a corner again on withdrawing. We're going to stay the course. And he's talking about vetoing the appropriations bill, which would be his own decision to cut off the funding of the war. This is being taken up in certain committees in Washington, D.C. right now. And Bush is not, George Bush is not really willing to cooperate. So it's a very difficult situation, and the Republican Party right now is becoming more and more frustrated and intolerant to this insanity. So LaRouche is saying they're ready to take out the knives politically on Bush. But what needs to be done is we've got to get Cheney out of there. There's no going around that. Been saying this since 2003. Impeach Cheney, and we can save the presidency. Impeach Cheney, we can lay out a new political agenda toward dealing with this war crisis. Impeach Cheney, and we can avoid a war with Iran. Impeach Cheney, and maybe the Democrats will have a little bit more balls to be more upfront with what they want to do, because they do want to cooperate. But the problem is, you still have Cheney around. If you get rid of Cheney, we can begin to manage the presidency. But the Democrats are going to have to show themselves willing to fight for that. And if they're willing to fight against Cheney and take him down, we can get him to reject the influence of Rowatim and others, because we'll be in a position of control, policy-wise, setting the agenda. That is our movement, specifically because of the role that we're playing. And it's becoming more dangerous having Cheney around, because he is intent still on starting a war in Iran for the sake of instigating a further crisis that would spread into Russia, that would be aimed at China. Cheney's policies, George Shultz's policy, is Tony Blair's policy to continue to push for globalization. One world government seems like a far out conspiracy or something like that. You have all of these different images. It's because of what we've been culturally indoctrinated with. But it is a fact that in the midst of where we are in terms of the financial system, that globalization is being pushed as the solution. You want to establish absolute globalization. You don't want a Franklin Roosevelt impulse coming from anywhere. And in order to do that, you instigate strategic conflict. You create the conditions politically and geopolitically in certain regions of the world where it would be become impossible for dialogues to occur around sustainable peace. And that's what Cheney's up to right now. We're getting reports, we're posting this up, and we're keeping it updated on our website. But this is something new that we recently just put out, and I'll just go through it real quick, and then we can proceed. Hopefully I can we can field some questions on some of the stuff that I went through. But I'll just go through it real quick. It's just a quick news report that we put up on our website. CBS's Nightline reported last night that the U.S. is advising and supporting the Baluchi guerrilla organization, Jundula, which is running raids into Iran from Pakistan, killing and capturing Iranian military and intelligence personnel. It was Jundula, for example, which claimed responsibility for the February attack on a bus in Zehdan, Iran, which members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard were killed. The group's leader, Abd el-Malik Regi, has posted videos on the internet showing him killing Iranians. Regi is described as a part drug smuggler, part Taliban, and part Sunni activist by Nixon Center fellow Alexis DeBott. The Nixon Center is a policy think tank, a policy institution in Washington, D.C. Certain analysts compare this with U.S. support for the Afghan Mujahideen, out of which came Al-Qaeda, as reported. But we had covered something on this, as well as an investigative reporter named Seymour Hirsch, who is a frequent columnist in the New Yorker magazine. And he's done a lot of work in conjunction with us on drawing out Cheney, specifically on the private military operations, the plot against Iran, and similar issues specifically pertaining to the war threat. Hirsch has been a very outspoken journalist in the United States. But he put something out on March 5th, 2007 called The Redirection. And we had also put something out based on reports that we were getting from intelligence sources in the Middle East. The report continues confirming that the Bush-Cheney administration was conducting a reorientation of its Middle East policy and to support Sunni groups and governments against Iran and Shiites in general. Hirsch also reported that this involved cooperation with Al-Qaeda sympathizers in covert operations aimed against at Iran. And he specified that Dick Cheney was running the Candlestein operations side of these operations. Okay, then it goes on to report a meeting that Cheney had discussing the Jundula operation when he met recently with the president of Pakistan, I think. President Musharraf in February. So we're looking into this, Cheney's involvement in running these cells into Iran, because it's just important to note, Cheney recently had a trip to Riyadh in the beginning of the year in January, where he met with King Abdullah, Saudi Arabia, and other leaders of the Middle East, and other Sunni leaders. And he and Condoleezza Rice were specifically roaming around the Middle East to try to create an alliance against a Sunni, an Israeli Sunni alliance against the Shia people and Iran specifically. We had put this out in the beginning of January in a detailed report written up by Jeff Steinberg on this. So we're continuing to look into this and track it. Because although Cheney operates behind the scenes in most cases, we do have access to figuring out what he's doing, and we have been the leading source of intelligence worldwide that has been publishing these endeavors that Cheney's been involved in to get a war instigated with Iran. But like I said, would only act as a pretext or a stepping stone to instigate a further crisis northward in toward Russia. Because the idea is you don't want a strategic alliance. We can't have sovereign nation states and globalization coexisting at the same time. And we're going to have to make the decision now what that's going to be, because the U.S. dollar right now is hanging by a thread, tied up in the subprime mortgage market, tied up in the collapse of hedge funds that are tied into the collapsing auto industry, mortgage lending companies that are going bankrupt, etc. This is having a strain on the population of the United States, the population of the world, where people are being bled for the purpose of maintaining an already bankrupt financial system. And we've gotten to the point where the policy now for control over the current crisis we're in is extending itself toward a general war policy, which is the real threat. So we're right in the middle of this thing again, as everything else. And what LaRouche discussed at this town hall meeting is front and center in world politics today. And like I said, we're reaching out to youth in particular to be involved with us in shaping the political and intellectual culture of our generation, to set the agenda around the four nation strategy politically worldwide, and the LaRouche's policy to reorganize the world financial system to be the element of change in this whole situation. Because it's going to be impossible to go to the baby boomer generation and ask them to do such things. It's a fact of life. You go to your professors, you try to talk to them about politics, ideas, and in most cases, the intellectual stimulation around ideas is very very dim, but also the passion is lacking. The passion to actually have a revolutionary identity is something that is a very that's a quality that you've got to really pull out of certain leaders of the baby boomer generation. But one thing that we do know is that young people can be organized. Young people know that we've got 50 more years to live, and the world right now doesn't have a serious future. Probably not for us, but also thinking about two or three generations into the future. We just can't do it physically. We got to change the planet. We got to do good things and develop the planet through economic infrastructure. We got to bring water to the places where it's needed. We need to educate millions of people. But the way you do that, you're not going to be able to reach every single person. But the way you do it is a very concentrated core of leadership that's willing to carry the ball right now and push and provide the political leadership to create an effect on a larger scale, which does change the way people think and does change the way policy is discussed and the outlook toward how we're going to respond in the short term, but also in the long term. That's going to be driven by youth. And we can, hopefully we can inspire some of the leaders of the older generation to get on board with us. But right now, it's what we've got, 18 to 35 year olds are going to determine the next 50 years. So that's what I wanted just to present politically, where we are, what we're up to, and if there's a few questions, and some of the things that I covered or didn't cover, we can take some time, a few minutes.
Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't get to read your magazine here. You're claiming that the increase in the world temperature is not linked to CO2, right?
Yeah.
Correct. There's no link.
Well, I personally wouldn't be able to prove, like, statistically a zero link. But what I'm saying, to the degree that the entire planet is going to be submerged by rising sea levels in 10 years, no.
Okay, you're claiming that that Antarctica is not melting and that the polar ice caps are not melting, basically.
No, because it happens all the time.
They're not melting?
Huh?
They're not melting?
No, I said I'm not claiming that. I'm not claiming they're not melting because they
but you're saying that it's not linked to CO2.
No. I'm saying the report that was put out by the IPCC is a fraud.
In what way?
And the way that they consciously rejected over 100 years of previous data going back to the middle of the 1800s, where CO2 emissions were measured and showed a higher density of CO2 in the atmosphere than we have today in terms of parts per million. We published this. We have a mass leaflet circulating. And
where was the CO2 measured?
Huh?
A century ago. Where was it measured? Because the recent measurements were done in Hawaii, I believe, far from emission sources. 100 years ago, was it done near emission sources or far away from emission sources?
I'm not exactly sure where they were done.
Rural areas around Europe, a few years off the ground.
Okay.
No emission sources.
Okay, far enough.
Mm-hmm.
There's good.
Yeah,
no cities.
Besides the state, but also Hawaii is a volcano. There's two major sources of CO2.
Mauna Loa, yeah.
You know, the globe on the Earth, I would say. And it's volcanoes and the seas. So if you want to be a big star, I don't know where yet, but good one.
Another question. You're saying that the way to go is nuclear power. How is it sustainable?
Well, that's a good question, because we're driving the frontier in that field of science right now in our youth movement with Kepler.
Can you elaborate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've got a crash program. I'm going to show you a few things here, which you're welcome, and I'll encourage you to work through them. This is our website. We've got to clean it up a little bit. Playing the role more of the library right now than an interactive. website, but we've got this in here. The work that we've done so far on Kepler, and we've had two teams of task forces deployed specifically for months at a time to work through Kepler's actual work, material that is published and translated by, not by Kepler, but from Kepler, directly getting at Kepler's mind, not some intellectual or academician or mind about Kepler. And so we've got this work on the harmony of the world, which is Kepler's presentation.
The new astronomy.
The new astronomy is Kepler's presentation on his discovery of universal gravitation. We do have classes on this, but I just want to give you a little bit of familiarity with it. And like for example, we've read through it. We've written up reports that are actually being used in our organizing in Congress to educate congressional staff and others on the work we're doing, so that they have the capacity also of thinking through the popular mess of this global warming stuff, and also other forms of policy, but specifically getting to the core of scientific method.
I'm trying to understand what's new about this new astronomy.
Well, what Kepler did is he crushed a popularly accepted dogma of the theory of the organization of the solar system. That was LaRouche saying this was run as a hoax by Claudius Ptolemy. And this shaped scientific thought for 1,500 years. And Kepler actually does that. He refutes. He refutes Ptolemy in particular. And then he goes on to show how Copernicus and Tycho Brahe's outlook toward the general dynamic of the solar system had been shaped by the fraud of Ptolemy. Kepler's method also, in addition to doing that, Kepler is very consciously reviving a method which stretches back to the Pythagoreans and the Egyptians, which is spherics. And the notion of a non or an anti-Euclidean geometric system, where the only resources you have is the universe itself and the potential in your own mind and the power to reason. And for example, spherics was the science that was developed before Greek civilization, centered around things like astronavigation and trade, and things like that, traveling the oceans. And the Egyptians were involved in building pyramids that were able to do astronomical observations also. And this is expressed in the work of the Pythagoreans, such as the work of Plato, Archytas.
So you're basically stating that Newton is wrong and Einstein is wrong, and so on and so forth.
Not Einstein, because I don't grasp his full method as such, but he attributes his own scientific method to Kepler. But Newton is wrong, yeah. Newton is wrong because...
Well, obviously Einstein came afterwards. So,
yeah.
Obviously corrected Newton,
Newton is wrong because he... Because this is the thing. This is how you can look at also what Al Gore's up to. Because people say, well, that's interesting. I never thought of Al Gore being a fat Southern racist from Tennessee, or an evil man who's who blew up a pharmaceutical lab in Africa. But don't you think what he's doing is a good thing, spreading awareness about the environment? Sure, he may run a hedge fund and be involved in speculation and carbon trade, but it's a good... Never before in 20 years has the environment been the major issue. Well, you can also say that about Isaac Newton. Well, don't you think he contributed good things to science? Well, what we know about Newton is that he wasn't really a scientist. He was a magician. And also, Newton was involved in organizing a grouping centered around a number of salons that were established among certain existential scientists like Louis de Maupertuis and Euler, Leonard Euler, specifically to attack Gottfried Leibniz and mimic and dumb down the ideas of Leibniz. Like, for example, Maupertuis, this guy Louis de Maupertuis, had in one of the major academies in Europe, I don't remember exactly which one it is, had organized an essay writing contest which was intended to refute Leibniz's thesis on the monadology, which is a philosophical dissertation on his calculus. And you had a board of judges that was appointed to review these essays, and Leonard Euler was involved. He was one of the judges put on this panel. But the most ridiculous submissions were praised as the higher hypothesis in development upon Leibniz and monadology. So you had these kind of things. You had these kind of things that came out of the debates that Newton and Leibniz had, specifically on the question of God and the nature of man, because Leibniz was, in fact, the founding father of the United States. Because his idea of happiness was directly adopted by Benjamin Franklin and was fought out against the Lockean notion of property and inserted in the U.S. Federal, the Declaration of Independence. It was a fight specifically taken up by Benjamin Franklin, who was a Leibnizian, through Abraham Kessner and also another guy, Vattel, who was also in the Americas at the time of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, who was promoting Leibniz's ideas. And what we're looking at here, see, the approach that we're taking in science is not academic, because scientific discovery is part of the human identity. And what we're learning from the music work that we're doing, the bel canto voice training that we're involved in, and the work on Johann Sebastian Bach, is that there's an indispensable quality of passion that has to be located within the individual soul that allows a person to make a creative discovery and also communicate that to other minds, which is valid universally, like Kepler's discovery of gravitation. And what we're going to begin to work on is Leibniz's calculus more in depth. We've already done some preliminary investigations, but we're which we're reviving a science that has been buried in academia for, like, what we're doing with this animations project hasn't been done in this scale on the level that we're doing it around the world ever in history before. Like, Kepler's work wasn't even translated into English before the 1970s. So we're taking that approach. We're interested in developing a scientific method of thinking that doesn't conform to an axiomatic system of definitions, axioms, and postulates. We actually want to break free of that, because LaRouche emphasizes, in the words of Einstein, that the universe is finite but unbounded. Meaning that, in the way LaRouche is looking at it, that the universe is bound by man's relationship to the universe and other human beings, based on the knowability and a general knowledge of universal physical principles, their characteristics, and the way they operate. And gravity is where we're starting, because then we can begin to look at other things in that light, since Kepler is the founder of modern science. So we're taking that route, going through Kepler. We got a task force now that's working on we've done the new astronomy. We've done Kepler's validation of his discovery of universal gravitation through the harmonies of the world, where he develops the relationship between the solar system and a well-tuned musical scale.
Can you actually compute the position of the planets?
Huh?
Can you actually compute the positions of the planets?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're working on it. The book is somewhere around here, but yeah, you got to do that. Kepler just piles it on. He's rigorous, and he gives you everything. And in order to know what he's presenting, you have to do it. Even if the more stubborn part of your mind and personality wants to resist, in order to know anything, you've got to fight to overcome these blocks, and because we don't have a scientific culture, okay? So in working on this stuff, a lot of the challenges come from the fact that there's just not a general intellectual culture, a scientific culture, where these kind of things can be discussed. So we're doing it. We've got to do it now. And yeah, that's what we're doing. We got a group of people working on now, taking it a step further, trying to figure out how, based on what Kepler did, Gauss determined the orbits of two asteroids, Ceres and Pallas. After this project, we're going to be going into an investigation of Leibniz's calculus, and then that would allow us to arrive at a point where we're ready to deal with Bernard Riemann's presentation of hypergeometric functions and things of that sort. But that's the direction we're working in. And it's a very straight, clearly defined, narrow path, which is going to allow us to begin to look at look at everything else from the standpoint of this tradition in science.
So you're starting from musical scales and you're working your way through hypergeometry.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's fun. It's like, yeah, because this is where Bach's mind really dwells. Because he took up Kepler's challenge. Once Kepler presented the harmony of the world, Bach was very much influenced by what Kepler left behind, this question of music. And
are you claiming that everything is coded in Bach's work?
Huh?
Everything is coded in Bach did? Or what? I mean, his music or something like that?
It's not coded, no.
Okay.
Like, you're not going to... No, but what I said earlier about this idea of passion... It's the same thing in science. You can't really make a scientific discovery if there's no passion for the ideas that you're dealing with. And this is something that only human beings experience. But like I said, there's more stuff on the website. We can talk about it more. We're going to be going down to Boston in 2 weeks to work with our choral director, John Segerson. He's going to be in Boston. There'll probably be a few presentations on Kepler's work on the harmonies while we're down there. But this is what's driving us as a political movement. The fact that the only solution is like. Developing a serious identity in history and fighting to do as much good as you can while we're here, because there's not a guarantee that we're going to survive this crash. There's no code, there's no formula that's going to be able to do this, and that's why I want Pascal to get into what he had prepared, because it may just elaborate on the discussion and how that's the case, how it's only human civilization that can deal with where we are today in the world and establish a future, and not something arbitrary, like human beings who dominate our role, which is more directly what allows for any real change in the universe. So yeah, that's where I'll end.
It's true.